to do to review class actions before we get to default judgment, see if you have any questions on it. So I just put up what we already discussed, but to refresh your memory, here the plaintiffs are alleging that women employed in Walmart stores were basically subject to payment inequities based on the fact of gender and promotion inequity, that they were passed by for promotions or had to wait a very long time to get a promotion because of their gender. And since it's a nationwide chain, they basically have to allege that it was a discriminatory policy that occurred nationwide. And if you look at evidence, Walmart's not going to have anything in place that says, well, we just only promote men at any of the like higher levels. And so the other aspect that you can kind of get stung by is if as a nationwide corporation, you have a ton of subjectivity. Like, there's no standard. They just kind of let every store do whatever they want. Because those kinds of things also really are, you know, a subterfuge for, it's kind of the way that we can hide discriminatory practices. And they didn't have either of those things. What they're saying is, we didn't do that. We actually had a policy in place. We have to have some subjectivity at the local level, because they're the ones that actually see the employees and decide how they fit the standard. But the standard we employ is the same and is principled and is not based on gender discrimination. The plaintiffs disagree. So they really point to a lot of people who are both in part-time entry level, hourly employees, and salaried managers. They seek injunctive relief to stop the policy, punitive damages, back pay. But they say we don't seek traditional compensatory. What we are, back pay is like, I was supposed to get promoted, you didn't. With the promotion, I would have gotten XYZ more dollars per paycheck. So since the time I can prove that you passed me up for an unlawful reason, the employment discrimination laws, both at the state level and at the federal level, allow us one damage to go back and recalculate your salary, and you get that. That's what back pay is. And punitives, we all know what those are. Okay. The average loss is just over $1,000. So in the end of the day, would this be a claim that any lawyer would likely take if it was just like Sally or Dukes, who would just come to them and say, hey, I think Walmart's been discriminating against me? Not for $1,000. Not even close. They wouldn't even, like, maybe entertain the conversation for any length of time. All right, so the plaintiffs here are arguing that because of the nature of employment at Walmart, it just sets up a situation in which they can kind of hide behind the fact that they're litigation proof, that no one would do it. So that's really why the class action, I think, has made such big news, because it would radically change if this kind of employer can be subject to a nationwide lawsuit on discrimination, the way businesses operate. Plaintiffs would suggest it's a good thing. Defendants suggest it's a bad thing for business, especially since they're going to be put to a class, and so they don't have a lot of time to defend themselves because the pressure of settlement at that point is going to be so extreme. So, the only other thing I didn't tell you is the representatives. There's several different named party representatives. They have slightly different aspects to their claims. To give you an example, Dukes, who's the named one in all the things that you see, is also claiming racial discrimination in addition to gender discrimination. The rest of the parties, plaintiffs, don't have that. Some of the class members do, though. One of the other individuals who's not claiming anything other than gender discrimination, her claim kind of works out as, every time I go to work, you tell me you should dial up more before when you get here, and would kind of yell at her and berate her in a way that the employer or the manager didn't do to other people. Another named party member says, I don't have any race discrimination. I never got yelled at. I never got told dial up or anything like that. But I just got the cold shoulder. And anytime I'd ask about a promotion, they would kind of shrug it off and be like, oh, but you're so good as the cashier. But would tell everybody else who are men, they should really be pursuing the manager role. So they have very kind of different stories. So it kind of gives you the idea of what the reps look like. And I showed you what the class definition was. All women employed at any Walmart domestic retail store at any time since December 26, 1998 until present, who have been or may be subjected to Walmart's challenged pay and promotion track.
Why was that specific date chosen? Is there a statute of limitations?
I don't know. My guess is probably. Or they just thought feasibility, as far as if you get too far, then the class itself can become unfeasible, which Walmart's arguing is already. My guess is statute of limitations. But I don't know. I didn't look that up. If we look at that class definition, let's look at the prerequisites, and I'd like you to click in with which one, if any, of these are a concern for you. I gave you the option of none if you think there's none. As far as those initial class prerequisite options, the numerosity, commonality, typicality, adequacy of representation, or E, none, of these options, what would best describe what you think about this particular class? What do you think? I'm looking for what you think would be the most difficult acquaintance to show.
Thank you. For what to you, if you were to put your first time, then I'll be like,
as opposed to not. All right, so I'm looking for what you think is the most difficult for the plaintiffs to show.
If you don't think they have any problems, include none. Dan Talbert.
What do you think is most difficult for the plaintiffs to show? What do you think is most difficult for the plaintiffs to show? If you haven't already, go ahead and click in so we can just get a representation of the class here. The district court and the circuit court, which is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, if you follow the news in this at all, certified the class. They found all the prerequisites to exist, and the Ninth Circuit, with a split decision, upheld that. They remand certain pieces that we're not going to get into because it's really hyper-technical discrimination law issues with respect to institution of employment versus fired and seeking an injunction of relief. But if you are interested in labor disputes, I'm happy to talk about it outside of class. Okay, so most people have found issues with what do we have this one? I put commonality and typicality, looks like. All right. So let's talk about them. We had a couple people on none, very few on adequacy representation, and actually a substantial piece here, six or so, 13% who clicked in on numerosity. Well, let's talk through them. Numerosity. The class is so large that it would be too difficult to join them together under normal joinder rules. This one, even Walmart says that's not a problem. In fact, Walmart uses the exact opposite tactic and says it's too big to actually make a feasible lawsuit, even as a class action. Now, it kind of depends upon who you talk about or who you talk to about it. Walmart and people who are very much into defending employers and discrimination cases and who have fought really hard to make sure that discrimination laws are such that it sets up to where you as an employer can actually carry on your business without threat of, like, false litigation. They're not saying we should do it and be able to discriminate. What they're saying is we can get sued, put up all this money to litigate and all this time to litigate, and really it tanks our business. And so for those people, this kind of class is entirely threatening because they see so many people who can come and say, you know, I used to apply, I was just there for even a summer college kid, and now I get paid back pay. And so it's very threatening. So they don't actually challenge that. So for those of you who thought numerosity was an issue, it isn't here for the reasons you're thinking. For numerosity, the question isn't, is it too big? The question is it big enough that we can say class is worth it? Okay? For the too big stuff, it's potentially an issue you look at if you're a B3 type of class, when we get to the type of class, the damages class, when we ask whether a class action is superior and we're looking at whether it can be maintained. That's when those arguments kind of come up. But being too numerous is really not what the issue is. It's being too few to suggest that a class action is appropriate. All right, commonality. This is a big one for Walmart. Does anyone want to articulate why they might have clicked on commonality as being a problem? This is one of their main arguments. The dissent in the Ninth Circuit fractures largely on this ground. Yes.
It's because you're dealing with employees at all different levels. You have some that are in this position, some that might be in a different position, so it's hard to say that there's a common claim between them?
Okay, let's hang on to that. The, like, different employees have different kinds of claims. It's going to come up in a slightly different variation in adequacy, which is in typicality also, which is where I think kind of that stylization goes. But let's flesh it out a bit. You said there's going to be kinds of different claims. Let's talk about that aspect, because I think that's what commonality is driven at. Why do you see the claims being different?
I guess I was thinking of the nature of their promotion or the lack of promotion would be different at the different positions they have.
Okay, so one thing might be because there's different things that go into making decisions about people who are managers versus people who are
you know, at a lower level of employment, okay, good. That might be an issue. If it's something where there's a lot of people who might have that in common, though, like let's say all managers versus all salary, or, you know, the hourly versus the salary kind of employees, managers versus people who are doing the basic greeting and checking and stocking and all the other stuff that you do at a store, we might be able to do what we call subclasses. Remember in our last class we talked about one of the operational tools of Rule 23 is that it allows you to divide classes up. And if we find there's enough amongst those people, we can actually, in fact, divide it.
All right, but let's talk about what else might be different as to each employee. So we might find differences in groups. What else might we find different? What are they trying to prove? That there's a discrimination by Walmart in failing to give them adequate pay and failing to promote them?
No, because they're all seeking both.
Okay?
But that's good, and we're going to get to it when we get to type, so hang on to that argument. But think about the claim itself. Yes.
As far as the claim itself, I don't think it's likely that every single woman employed by Walmart was treated exactly the same way. I mean, there's some who could and others weren't. Some were moving along that.
Okay, good. Yeah, That's exactly what we're looking at, yeah.
I think job performance plays a big part in this, too, and every case is going to be unique as far as how they perform on the job.
Great, and I really think it's the two arguments here together. The first argument goes to the claim itself about whether or not we were in fact discriminated against. And so you have to look at, well, what happened in each case? And wouldn't that require you to look at the case-by-case, claim-by-claim level to decide whether or not, like at this regional store, it was the crazy manager who yells at women and tells them, you know, you really should look more pretty when you come to the job, versus this guy who's just kind of giving people a brush off every time they ask for a promotion. So that's very different. And if you're asking about a common discriminatory policy, that seems very different. So that's what the claims. They also say there's a lot different about the defenses. Walmart as a defense is going to say what?
We didn't promote you, not because you're a woman. We didn't promote you because
you performed poorly on the job, or we had better candidates, or couldn't meet our schedule.
It was a tough candidate pool, and amongst all these people had better qualifications for the following reasons.
And in order to do that defense, you're going to have to look at each individual candidate and the pool they were selected from, the job they were selected for, what their qualifications were, what the qualifications of the person actually got hired or actually got promoted are. Is that something you can say is a national question? No. So for Walmart, for people who are following Walmart with a lot of disdain and concern, that's the biggest thing.
It's that when you think about this kind of a lawsuit for these types of decisions, it is really hard, unless you've got that employer who really is operating in a way that says, you know, around Walmart, it's a old boys network, and that's how we want it to be, and we don't want anyone else in here. It's very hard to get a common group of claims. The only other commonality is maybe regionally we could do it. We could say there's a guy who's in charge of the region. He's pretty much trained everybody, and every time you see it, anytime he brings up a woman, it's always nine. There's always, and it's always this excuse that she's got a scheduling conflict, a.k.a. she's got kids, and we don't like that. You know, she's asked for maternity leave every time anyone does that. Having worked in the federal courts and seeing way more than I've ever wanted to see of discrimination claims, those are the ones that typically get somewhere when you have a group together. Walmart's a tough one because I think if you put yourself in the defense role, it's really difficult. Now, the district court found that there was enough in common. They said what the plaintiffs proved here was anecdotal evidence of what happened, but they also had a statistical analysis of across the country that the statistics ferreted out or merited out that this is exactly what was happening. Now, Walmart disagrees. They have their own statisticians. They paid a lot of people to do this too. So it's kind of the battle of the statistical experts who said, no, the statistics suggest that it's actually not statistical significance. It's not like an anomaly. It's within the range of expected aberrations from a set score. So if you ever work in this in law or anything where you have larger classes and you look at statistics, you spend lots of time relearning all that stuff. So. All right, so that's the commonality thing. Let's look at typicality, because several people had that. What was the argument you might have had about this isn't typical? It's kind of an argument we were making before, Joe, about why the named plaintiffs might not be typical of the class.
Because they might have had particular positions, and that's not the majority of the positions held by everybody else reading this.
Okay, good. And what you'll see is there's going to be kind of an over-duplication of some of the arguments in these three categories. Common alien typicality, very, very similar, though slightly nuanced. What you're saying is the named people in typicality aren't totally representative. They're not typical of these lawsuits. And the reason they're not typical is because everyone's got such individualized claims. And that beats the commonality argument. There's too many individualized decisions here as opposed to uncommon decisions. And so for the same reason that they're not typical is also why they're not common. Is that true of every lawsuit? No. Sometimes you'll get a typicality challenge that you picked out the, like, cherry case to bring at the party so that when we go up against this person, they look, like, super injured, when in fact everybody else really isn't. Okay, sometimes that's a challenge. That's not what we're having here, because they all have roughly the same money damages they're looking at, roughly around $1,000, even the parties that they selected. It's just that their situation is so unique from everybody else's situation, which is the same reason commonality is a problem. Yeah.
Is that why they selected three class reps that had different types?
Yes.
Kind of, like, one was sort of sexually harassed, mm-hmm. harassment, one was sort of racial discrimination, to kind of get the class to fall under those?
Yeah, if you have, well, that's primarily more for the last one, for adequacy of representation. You have to have someone who's representative of the pool. And so they try and select a divergent amount of people so that it looks like those members are going to be adequately represented. But yes, that's sort of the reason. So for that last one, which we had a couple people click on, but not many, Walmart actually argued this quite vigorously too. And they have one point that no one's raised. And it kind of relates to the fact that some of the party and some of the class members are themselves managers. Can anyone see what the challenge might be to adequacy of representation if some of the parties, and in fact some of the members of the class, are managers?
Kind of a conflict of interest.
That's exactly what it is. Why is it a conflict?
Because the managers are the ones that sometimes do the promoting and make these decisions on whether or not who should get promotions and such.
In fact, they are. In Walmart's sort of way of operation, the managers are the people who have been empowered to make these decisions. And so to win on their claim, they have to say that the managers were engaging in a nationwide policy of discrimination on the basis of gender. And that's very difficult to do when your parties are managers themselves. So you're basically saying you were discriminated against, and who were you discriminating against? The members of the class, other members of the class. And so could you really adequately represent their interests when you're in this lawsuit? They're saying we, too, were subject to discrimination. It's just the question is, can they avoid any potential conflict of interest of settling out? You know, I think this one's kind of beefed up because in the end of the day, we're not going to see a true conflict in the sense of it's not the managers who are going to be individually responsible, where you'd say, of course I'd want to settle because I'm going to be on the hook, right? Here it's just Walmart because of the shield of principal-agency relationship and respondeat superior, only Walmart is going to pay. They're not going to come to the manager and be like, pony up, we lost in our big lawsuit. You know, you're a manager, and if you just done a better job, look, we wouldn't be here. That's not going to happen. So I don't think it's the same level of conflict of interest that typically will get you bumped in a class. But I think Walmart makes a fairly compelling argument. I just don't think it's as convincing as commonality. For me, I think the biggest thing is the commonality piece, and whether or not they get past that. Because then many of the other pieces hinge on commonality. I think that's going to be the problem. Right, if we look at the next piece, the type of class, which one, if you were to certify this class, do you think you would say it fits? So you get any one of these, and I also gave you, I don't think it fits anything as an option. So you should have something up there you feel like you can click on. Okay, if you were to certify this as a type of class, which type of class do you think you put it in? Okay, I'm going to give you 30 seconds, so go ahead and click in. Yeah. So most people have that it's a damages class. What motivated you to come to that conclusion? Why would you say you think this is a damages class?
So we ruled out the first one because just because you have to pay a lot of money to people doesn't make it inconsistent.
Remember, money damages, the fact that you might have a little bit to some people and a lot to others. Because Walmart kind of said, look, everyone's got a different level of discrimination, a different level of impact. That's not enough to be incompatible. I can pay people different amounts. Yep.
For the second one, we didn't know of any like statutory cap on
it's Walmart.
Yeah.
I don't think they got limited funds even if you were not worrying about a statute, so.
Right. And so then between injunctive and damages, we just thought it was damages because, like the car case, where they also wanted injunctive relief and damages, mm-hmm. it just seemed like their damages brought them together more than the injunctive relief did. So that's why we did.
Okay. And that's what Walmart's trying to argue. Why are they trying to argue that, if anything? Because there's opt-out provisions, so people might jump out of the class. The other reason is you have to do what for a damages class? Someone brought this up, I think. Yeah.
Notice.
And what was the problem with that in this kind of class?
Right. Probably the mailing, which would cost the attorney of the class members over $1 million to mail the notices.
Yeah, that's what they kind of argued, that at this point they felt like even just providing notice would be upwards of $1 million. And so if you think about eating out of the potential awards you can get, that's quite significant. Now, the court here says it's an injunctive class. They basically point to the fact that what they say is really being certified is the question of the discriminatory policy, and that should we go on to do the rest of the issues, we can break that up into individual lawsuits about actual damages. But I think the reality is, like, you know, you're not going to completely get that free of the suit. What they're hoping for is to go on the injunctive class and then settle for money damages. That's what's going to happen if they get through the Supreme Court. Your guess is as good as mine. The Supreme Court has recently had a case called Falcon. So if you're interested in discrimination law or in employment law, or if you're thinking about maybe being an in-house counsel someday, this is something you should make yourself apprised of. It'll kind of give you some more prediction, I think. I think that's the most recent one that will be predictive of what they do. But with the new configuration of the Supreme Court since that case, it's very hard to predict. I think you know, people try and say, well, they are very conservative, they're very liberal, this is how they're going to vote. And I'll tell you, if you actually chart what justices do, it's a little bit trickier than that. So we'll see. Sabrina, do you have a question?
Yeah. So just to clarify between the two classes, if you have damages class. You can get damages as well as injunctive relief, but an injunctive class is purely injunctive.
No, you can get in the injunctive class. What you're saying is this is primarily about injunctive remedy. It's not that you're limited only to injunctive relief. For damages class, you're saying that primarily it's about damages. So there's some mixture in which you can actually walk away with, but what you're saying is this is what this class is stylized to be. And because it's injunctive, we'd say, well, those interests are more similarly aligned. Remember the injunction, like, people who are trying to go against the companies dumping pollution in the neighborhood. So we're less concerned about the members not hearing about it, not getting notice. It's just a different kind of suit. You don't have to opt out. In fact, it's going to bind everybody. And in some ways, like, that's good for Walmart. That's also bad for Walmart. They were arguing for damages. I think they were thinking if they win damages, the suit's less attractive to continue. I don't know if that's necessarily true at this point. I think what they're really trying to do is win on the prerequisites and say this doesn't work. The other thing they get if they get a damages class, remember, it's not just saying that you get damages. You also have two other issues. Remember, you have to prove predominance of. Remember, predominance is like the adjective, so we need something else there. It's predominance of. Do you remember? What was it? Predominance of.
Legal or factual questions.
Yeah, the common questions of law and fact. And remember what we said was the hardest part about their prerequisites to me here? Commonality. So not only is it just showing commonality, now I have to show that they predominate over the individual ones. So getting a damages class has a lot of, like, extra arrows against the class certification. The other thing they have to show is superiority. Now, again, that's just a modifier. Superiority of what? Of the class action itself. And so why were they conceding, yet this is a huge, numerous suit, we're not going to challenge that in prerequisites? Because they're going to use it here. And so why are they going to say it's not superior to have a class action?
Because now we have a class that's so large that it's going to overwhelm the resources of the courts, overwhelm the resources of the individuals, and be something that you can't really litigate. It's not what we envision with litigation. So you have to, they think tactically. They didn't take a shotgun approach with prerequisites because they're hoping they can really win on that commonality. And if they don't, when they get to trust us as a damages class and win on that, they're hoping to sink it both under predominance of common questions of law or fact. We've already laid the foundation in our challenge on commonality and superiority. We gave you it's numerous. In fact, it's so numerous that the class action is not superior.
The damages class and limited funds class is basically about money.
But different, very different.
But different. Is there any amount of, like, superiority or predominance in limited funds? Because, okay, well, in that case, it seems like if Walmart had some, you know, if there was some statute on discriminatory things for Walmart, it would just make it easier for them to get certified. They wouldn't have to go through damages classes. So, like, limited funds makes it, I mean, it could be the exact same case, except for there's a statute that makes it easier.
Right, and it makes it easier to the extent that you're using a class action device for the plaintiff, but it's not easier for the plaintiff because now Congress has set out a limited cap. Nobody wants that. So they would never trade, oh, we get an easier certification route for we get a set cap on our damages. I mean, plaintiffs really want the pool to stay open, right? We want to play with as much money as possible. What you said, I'm never going to pay past this point, it's, you basically set your settlement. I mean, that's kind of the, that's the hidden card in settlement. That's the nice thing. Like, what will they walk away with this, you know, what's their top dollar? If you get a cap, you know what it is, and they know that you know, and that's it. You know, so you don't want that. You want to have as much money open to you as possible. Plus, it's very unlikely that Congress would do that.
They've been doing that typically for, like, niche industries, and I don't think Walmart meets that yet. Although, who knows? Who knows, so. All right. Okay, so if you are interested more in talking about, just seek me after class. I know that some people really do get interested in those things, so we're going to continue on to default judgments. All right, this is a nice little discrete topic. It's easy. But it also has some little nuances to it, so you shouldn't let it just kind of skip you by in your outline, because a lot of times people have one of those, like, crust-level understandings, and I ask you a multiple-choice question, which makes you understand the different subparts and how they're different, and that's where the, like, basic-level understanding will sink you, okay? So let's get a basic understanding just so we know where it fits, and then we'll build on it. Okay, what is default really about? Well, here's your sort of red flag issue trigger. In our case, let's say Parsons filed her complaint, and then Reckless fails to appropriately respond. Typically, the most common part of default, failing to file an answer, failing to plead in any way. The trickier part is when he does some things, like when he files a motion, he loses on his motion, what's he supposed to do? File his answer, but he never does. Is that default? Is that what we mean by default? Well, let's say he files a motion, he loses on his motion, he files an answer, but shortly after discovery starts, he's just kind of absent. Hey, you wanted those disclosures, I'm not really giving them over. Oh, you wanted a deposition, well, we're not available ever. You can keep subpoenaing me, and I'm just not going to show. And that question then is, later in the lawsuit, can we also get default? And so that's what we're going to talk about. One way to kind of figure it out is to think about what we're really trying to balance. Here, courts favor merits-based decisions. We don't like giving people default because the whole point of the court is to allow the parties to prove up and be heard on their issues. Remember, who's getting default? Who uses this device? Is it the plaintiff or the defendant? Who uses this device? Only the plaintiff. This is a plaintiff only. We're going to turn in Friday to when the defendant says you didn't do what you're supposed to be doing against the plaintiff. But default is the plaintiff against the defendant. Defendant, you're in default. DD. Defendant, you're in default. I'm the plaintiff using against you. Defendant's in default. All right. So normally, in a lawsuit, who carries the burden of proof and persuasion about the issues in the suit?
The plaintiff.
Plaintiff. So if we're giving them default and we like merits-based decisions, we're doing two different things. We're taking away even any discussion about the merits, and we're giving the victor the spoils when they didn't even give us any evidence that they were in fact going to be able to meet their burden of proof. So there's a big tension because that's kind of going against default judgments. We don't really like them for that reason. Why do we like them? Well, if you really need compensation, if we allow the other side to prevent that simply by doing nothing, the system kind of has a perverse incentive. Like, how do you get out of a lawsuit? Just don't do anything. And so default kind of makes you push to the game plate and actually play in the game. Otherwise, it's the kid who's like, well, I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Well, how do you get what you need if you can't push them to play, right? So that's what default is. But realize it's only for those situations, which is why Spencer puts that practice pointer in there. If you're like Johnny on the spot of, they're one day late, I'm going to file for default judgment, a lot of courts kind of slap you on the wrist. Because it's really for that ultimate, I'm going to walk away and not play. All right, so that's the generics of it. It's got two steps. The casebook author spells them out, the rule spells them out. The first is getting a default entry from the clerk under 55A. The second is getting the entry of the judgment under 55B. Okay, so we're going to talk about them in the context of a hypothetical. And say, you lend me $500,000 and I fail to pay you anything. And since it's being lent, let's assume we have some sort of contractual obligation to pay it back. You file a complaint for $500,000 and serve me with the complaint. I throw it in the trash and never answer up here because now I've got $500,000 and try and catch me if you can. All right. So the first step is getting an entry of default. So let's talk about that and figure out what you need to do. Mr. Harder? Okay, what rule are we going to go to get entry of default? 55A, very good. And who are we going to?
We're going to clerk.
The clerk. Now, do you know what the clerk is?
I can remind myself.
No, it's probably not there, but I'm just wondering just anecdotally if you knew, because I don't think he spells it out. The things like, you know, I remember when I first started actually working for the real time, you know, I did well in law school, and was like, oh, it's all going to be breezy, and walk out there, and I feel like, no one showed me where the staplers were at or how you walked us over there, like the practical thing. The clerk is someone who's in some jurisdictions is elected, others are appointed, and basically it's the office that you're going to, and they hire people who work for the clerk's office, and it's basically the filing people. Would you describe that kind of person as someone who's got a lot of discretion or someone who's sort of a numbers counter stamper person? It's a stamper person. I mean, the person who gets elected has some bigger decisions, but the actual, like, clerk that we're talking about here is a thank you, did you fill all the right paper, you checked all the right blocks, stamped, yes, get on my left. That's what we're talking about. All right? Now, the federal courts have clerks' filings both, like, in person, but they also take things online these days. But the reality is the rule doesn't reference either way, so they're just talking about accessing the clerk. You need to look at your local rules for how you do that. Because it changes district by district and division by division based on the resources they have is really what happens. But they're mostly moving over to online. All right. So what document do you give this clerk?
An affidavit.
Okay. You want to actually, in the rule doesn't specify this, but you typically file a motion as well because you're going to go with the court. But you're right. The rule just talks about an affidavit. What's an affidavit?
In this case, it's something that shows that you sought a judgment for affirmatively.
Okay, so you're basically swearing to it. So the affidavit, if that's what it's going to say, you're going to say they failed to plead or otherwise defend as provided by these rules, and I'm seeking a judgment for relief in the form of default. But you're asserting in it that they haven't done what they need to do. So that we're going to have to look to the remaining part of the rules, that they failed to plead or otherwise appropriately respond. An affidavit in a general sense is something that's basically under oath. So you attest to it, you sign to it. There's penalties of perjury and other penalties if you are lying. So you can't say, yes, I served this individual knowing full well you didn't, and say, now I get a default judgment. In fact, one of the basic things that most defaults are overturned on is failure to actually get service process of the original complaint. Because the people just didn't know they had to show up to court. Because either there was no personal jurisdiction over them or they didn't serve properly. Those are the big things you typically get vacations of these from. Okay, so that's the basic thing. The clerk gets all that stuff. They get your affidavit. You signed it. Do they have any option or do they have to give you the entry of default?
They have to give you the entry of default.
Okay, good. So what do you get at this point? You get something called entry of default. Are you done? No, especially when I label it step one, right? All right, so step two. How do you obtain then the default judgment? What rule are we looking to now?
55B.
Good, 55B. All right, in our case, am I going to go to B1? This is the tricky question. Or am I going to go to B2? Do I get to go to the clerk or do I get to go to the court?
B1.
Very good. And we're going to hold on to why in just a second. So we're in B1, which means we're going to go to the clerk. What kind of documents are we taking now?
Request and an affidavit.
Okay, request for judgment, and the affidavit this time says what? Our last one says they failed to appear or otherwise properly defend. So we already got that part out of the way. What are we attesting to now? Okay, we'll take a check. Take a second to look at the rule. You're doing excellent. So just take a look at the rule.
That your claim is for a sum that's certain to be made certain by computation.
Okay, good. That's the type of situation. So now your affidavit actually tells us what that actual amount. All right, so the affidavit says this is what our dispute was about. You know, I've already had my entry of default, and now I get my judgment. Can the clerk then decide whether to grant it or not, or do they have to give it to you?
They must give it to you.
That's right. Because they're a stamper, right? So it's either you meet the situation or you don't. They have no discretion. Right, that's why we have a different route here for when you need it. So let's talk about, you got the right part of the rule, why we went to the clerk. Let's spell out for everybody else why we actually went to the clerk and not the court. There's three reasons in that rule that tells us why, in this hypothetical, we had to go to the clerk.
Claims for a certain sum or sum that can be made certain by computation. Defendant has been defaulted for not hearing, and defendant's neither a minor nor incompetent.
Okay, good. So those are the three criteria. Okay, so the tricky part people typically goof up on. They see the clerk in A, don't really know what they're going to clerk for, don't really know what the affidavit needs to say in that one, and transpose it in B. Try to keep them straight. The first time you're escaping entry of default, the first one, not the judgment. And that you're serving only to the clerk, you're giving to the clerk the motion for default, and you're giving the affidavit saying they failed to appear or properly defend under the rules. That's the entry of default. The second time around, you actually want the judgment. And you can only go to them in this situation. Why do you think the rule kind of makes it like this? Why do you think they make it for a claim if for, and we call it sum certain? It's an awkward use of English language, but hey, we're lawyers, so we don't mind that at all. All right, so it's for a sum certain. Why do you think that's something that we can go, that we make a requirement before you go to the clerk? To go to the clerk as opposed to going to court. Your option really is, you're going to go to court or you're going to go to the clerk.
There's really no deliberation or investigation that needs to be done.
That's exactly right. Each one of these is on a, we wouldn't need someone who has discretion to do anything about it. Okay, the sum is certain. How do you know that a situation that our sum is certain? How'd you know on the one I gave you?
In this case, it flat out said it was a loan for $500,000 in concrete amount.
Good. You look to the complaint and see what was alleged. If you allege an actual figure of dollars, then you get the opportunity to go to the clerk because then it's a sum certain. The other one might be, like the calculation one, is back pay from the time I wasn't hired. If you set with the salaries, I can actually calculate that because I have the date spelled out. So that's what we mean like by calculation or something plus interest. We can calculate that. So we can grab out a little calculator and figure it out. Does that take any discretion? Button pushing. Okay, still. Yes.
If half of your claim is certain and half of your claim may need some discretion, can you split them between the clerk and the judge?
We will see that in just a second. Very good question. The answer is going to be no. Okay, yes.
It seems like the rule in the book and it says that you shouldn't enter default judgment for a couple of days, but you know this really good. You just claim default judgment, the clerk has to give you your money. After a couple of days, it disappears.
Well, okay. You mean like... Well, are you asking me the question of what does the rule delineate as the actual number of days, or are you asking me whether or not you should do this?
I'm saying, you could complain after the defendant doesn't respond for a couple of days, file under judgment.
Well, first of all, let's kind of spell it out for everybody, because I know everyone's going to be thinking about, like, wait a minute, how long do they have? Does anyone remember? How would you know if you're in that window? 21 days, remember they have to file their answer, so you're like on day 22. All right, good. So we're in that point. Does the rule permit you to do it?
Yes.
Yes. And we're going to get to in a second of, should you do it right at that moment or not? All right?
Yeah. Are we going to talk a little bit more about failing to appear? Because
yes.
The same hypothetical, but he answers your complaint.
Yeah,
and then
we will.
Doing anything.
Hang on, because we just want to get through the logistics of the two different routes, and then we'll talk about the specifics underneath it. And we'll also talk about why you may or may not want to. For some certains, there's less of a concern than when you're going to the court. But I'll tell you that in most situations, you think you're some certain. Like, could you make a some certain in person?
Yeah.
in our suit.
I think it's tough. I think you can for certain things, but you're likely going to have that mixed question, and we'll get to it in just a second, and the court chief said it's not certain.
Like, you know, how much does she actually injured, okay? All right.
But you get the advantage, like, for those of you who did draft your complaints of the sum certain, in default judgments, this is how it helps you out. It just kind of depends. So if it's for something that's contractual and clearly defined, it helps to actually spell it out in your complaint. We talked at the beginning, if you had the option, this is why it might help you. All right. Okay. And then the person is defaulted for, what was the defaulting for?
Defaulting for not appearing.
And so what we mean by this one is not appearing at all. We'll flesh out a little bit the differences between failing to appear at all and making an appearance, but not really the difference between default and failure to appear in just a moment. But this one is, think of it as the person doesn't show at all. And why is that the situation? Because there's no need to argue if whether there's been, like, any notice that's properly given to them, if they have made some form of an appearance. If they've made some attempt, we often give them the right to come to court and get that hearing before we get to fault. Yes?
Does the clerk have any discretion to say this is in the improper jurisdiction or anything
nope.
like that?
Nope.
So you could get a grant of $50,000 even though it's not $75,000.
And we'll talk in a moment about what happens if your client comes to you and tells you they did just that. You're not out of luck, it's just the clerk can't help you. Because we don't give the clerk that kind of authority.
But we don't say, oh, bad things can exist just because you were too late. We'll give you another route. All right, and the last one, you're neither minor nor incompetent. Why do we want those people to go through the court? I mean, go through the clerk? Well, again, we're looking for protection of their interests. It might be because of the incompetency that they didn't get their guardian, get aware of it. And so we don't want them just to go through the clerk's office. It's too atypical. That we're just going to let someone who stamps if you meet the qualifications give you the judgment of default. All right. In the end of the day, the other reason when we're talking about like why we don't want to get these, if you know, jump the gun, is you can still have ways to vacate them later. We'll talk about it in a second. Let's talk about the other route. Since we took the clerk's route, here's a separate hypo. You can see the difference. Parsons sues reckless for $2.5 million plus appropriate punitives. All right. First of all, if we look at it, and all we do is just throw away or reckless throws away the complaint in the trash and never appears or answers. That's the same from the last hypo. All right, if you're talking about the first step of obtaining entry of default, the rule is the same. The same.
Why? Because Part A doesn't delineate what kind of case you are. So the entry of default is really just that affidavit to the clerk to get the entry. You don't get your judgment yet, it's just the first step. But you still have to go through the first step no matter what hypo you are. It's the same, same, same.
Change it however you want, same answer. But now we're going to get a different answer. We're going to get a different answer. Let's see. Mr. Archer? Now we're going to go to what part of the rule?
55B.
Good. 55B, which part?
B2.
That's good. B2. Okay, so this is a different process now. And can you tell me why? Why can't we get a judgment from the clerk? Which one of these things is failing? The claim is not for some certain. The defendant did not default by failing to appear. The defendant is minor or incompetent. Which one's the problem now?
The first one.
Yeah. And so if you're asking me like a hybrid answer, the answer is now we can't go to the clerk.
If there's any aspect that's not a some certain, we have to go to the clerk. So most cases are following the second part under B2.
If you were a judge, what would you do? Well, B2 tells you you may have a hearing. And in actuality, they often do this because they don't like default judgments, you know? All right. All right, so let's talk about then, so that's the basics of the process. Let's talk about what it means to fail to appear, how you get in there, the nuances to it. This is the part of your outline that we've covered so far, is the skeletal structure of this answer. What we're going to do now is fill in that skeletal structure with some more detailed rules. All right, so the first part is how do you know if this is someone who has failed to plead or otherwise defend to get that entry of default? We're going to define those terms, failed to plead or otherwise defend. Those are the operative words, failed to plead or otherwise defend. Circle those. Those are the ones I want to see. Failed to plead or otherwise defend. So what does that mean? What about our first one? Defendant reckless files an answer to make a motion under Rule 12 but puts the complaint in the trash. I'm not going to have you click in because I think this one's pretty obvious of failing to appear or plead or otherwise defend, is that a failure to plead or otherwise defend? That's like the best case scenario for failing to plead or otherwise defend. This is sort of like, yeah, whatever, about your lawsuit. Okay, so that's clearly it. That's not the ones where you're going to have this at issue. But it's a clear hypothetical. Where does it get tougher? Well, the next couple ones are a little tougher. Hypo D from your worksheet. Defendant reckless files an answer, then defendant reckless fails to engage in discovery or otherwise attend pretrial conferences. Can plaintiff Parsons obtain a default entry? Can you get a default entry at this point? People are saying no, that's the general answer here. I mean, it's not an absolute, but generally the courts are not going to give you default in this situation. Why? Has he appeared? Yeah, what did he do? Yeah, he actually filed not only a motion. No, he filed an answer. He filed a pleading, which is much more active participation in the case. So failed to plead or otherwise defending, he's clearly pleading here. And for default judgments, we really don't want to use this behavior to get yourself into default. Does that mean, as a defendant, that you're incentivized to answer and then not engage in discovery or attend any pretrial conferences? What might happen if you do that? Sanctions. Remember all those lovely things we learned about at 26? And so the rules of the courts pretty much are saying, look, early on, if you're not gonna come at all, we need to have a pretty big penalty. You're going to have to pay out everything unless you come and participate. But once you start participating, we're pretty sure that our sanctions are going to take care of you and keep pushing you along the way. The people we're worried about who need the ultimate, you're going to have to pay everything, are the kids who, I'm going to take my ball and leave. That's who we're worried about. People are like, well, this just isn't fair. I'm getting mad and ticked. We have sanctions for those people. All right? So anything where they're starting to answer, you're really unlikely to get it. This one's the trickiest of all of them because sometimes you will get, in fact, a lot of times for this one, you will get a default judgment. This is where they didn't file an answer at all. There's no pleading, but they are defending. So the tricky part is, are they otherwise defending? Yes, but then they stop. And so for a lot of courts, this one is default. Okay? Sure way to avoid getting a default answer. Forever, that one's never going to be a default. You'll still get sanctioned if you don't participate, but you won't default. Filing a 12B6, getting it denied, and then stopping, never answering, you might get entry of default judgment. Okay? I'm hearing some whispering. Is there any questions?
So that one's just maybe...
Yeah, I mean, it's more likely to be a situation where you're going to get an entry of default, but it's something under the rule that the court has discretion on whether or not they decide. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you said that the clerk doesn't have much discretion.
Right.
Just bringing this to the clerk, I mean, how do they make this decision?
Well, because what you're going to do is whether or not you can appeal later, that they got an entry of default and they shouldn't have. That's where we see it. So you'll see some different aberrations. In the end, I think the easiest thing to say is this one you can put down yes if you're more comfortable with that. But I'll tell you, there are some cases out there where they've challenged it on appeal and they've gotten a reverse. So just look at your jurisdiction with the answer to that one. Yes?
Do they go to the clerk for default judgment here?
And this one, whether they go to the clerk or whether they go to the court is based on whether it's some certain. So that's the judgment part. The entry part, you always go to the clerk.
Okay.
A is always the clerk.
Okay.
All right?
Failing to appear for trial, that was at the end of our meeting on the paper that we had. That.
For a pretrial conference? Yeah.
No, just
well, you mean in his book, yeah. Mm-hmm.
For trial.
Yeah.
Curious. Is that failing to otherwise defend?
No, that's not going to be a default ever. Okay. The reason why is if you've answered, you've denied the allegations. And whose burden of proof is it at trial to prevail? Plaintiff. Does the defendant really have to do anything if it's the plaintiff's burden? No. Should they not show? No. But if they don't, it's not a default judgment. All right. So, if you look back when you're filling things out, the first one is for C is definitely yes, for D is no, and for E is yes. But you know for D and E, there's a few scattered appellate decisions that have changed things. Now, the clerk can't. The clerk is going to, in their jurisdiction, yes, no, if it fits the box. But when you're out as a lawyer and someone presents you with one of these, look and see if you have some wiggle room based upon what you did. Okay? Yes?
When would this rule be more appropriate to use over 37A or D?
For, you're talking about discovery?
Like for, yeah. Oh, I guess that's discovery, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So you wouldn't use it if you're in discovery. Because you they're not defaulting at that point because they've answered and they've engaged in the process. Because that one would be D, and that's a definite no, it's not entry of default. That one's completely no. Okay. How can a defendant appear but be in default? And we've talked a little bit about this because if you look at 55B2, it talks about that. These kind of people get notice of the hearing 7 days before the hearing. And so it presumes, without defining for us, that there are some people who have somehow appeared but are not default. So let's try and define these a little bit. Default is defined as failure to appear. Failure to appear, I think, is best defined, if you look at your casebook, that little box, the food for thought box on page 705, is a good way of describing this, although there's no rule-based definition anywhere. You make no presentation or submission to the district court. That's really, truly default. You make no presentation or submission to the district court. That's why that one hypo is sometimes a little trickier with the filing the motion to dismiss and why some jurisdictions get a little bit weirder about it. Because if they take an absolute no presentation at all, then a motion to dismiss would be the otherwise defend. All right. So how can you appear and yet default? Okay. One of the classic ways was that hypo we did talk about in a situation where they consider it too not default is getting a motion denying a no answer. The other ways are writing letters, like a letter to the court or a letter to the other side, might constitute an appearance, but you're not really in that situation. You're appearing, but you didn't actually default. So what you're looking for is some behavior that will let you default, but that otherwise counts as an appearance. And so it's like, I've done something, but I haven't really done what I'm supposed to do, which is like plead, give my answer to you, or actually do more than just file the motion to dismiss. All right. What happens if you do that? Well, in this situation, we can only go to one route now for our judgment, our entry of our judgment of default. Who do we go to now? Can we go to the clerk? No. So, for those people who are like, well, the clerk has no discretion, what are we going to do? Okay, she'll give you the entry of default, the entry of default, the actual first one, but that doesn't give you the money damages. Now we foreclose you to go to that person who doesn't have discretion. So, that's why there's no panic. And why I wasn't panicked when you're like, they don't have discretion, that's why. Because now, for the judgment, you actually have to go to the court. What other thing do you get? If someone appears but still is in default, we're only going through B2 route and they get notice. So there's two consequences if someone appears, but still is in default. You can still get judgment from them, but you can't go to the clerk for the judgment piece. And they get notice of a hearing. You can't go to the clerk for judgment, you have to go to the court, and they get notice. Yes?
So there's two ways that you have to go to court. Way number one is if you don't have some certain.
Remember, there's three, remember? Because it's some certain, they totally failed to appear at all, and they're not a minor or incompetent. So if you find any of those things, you can't go to the clerk under B1. Okay. Yeah, so it would be, just so you know where that one was at. Yeah, it was just this is what it was. So for all of those, kind of tying it back together, when you're putting those back in the skeletal outline, that's where it goes. Okay. And always think about it as two steps. Don't ever get too panicked with one or the other because realize the entry of default is nothing more than just an initial on our docket. You have an entry of default that you preserved your ability to get judgment. It isn't the money yet. And we only let you go to the clerk if it's truly easy. All right, so the last bits of it, what happens if you're too late? It's day 22. Plaintiff Parsons' counsel realizes that defendant Reckless has not yet filed an answer or a motion to dismiss. Should she seek a default entry from the clerk? Could she, first of all? Yes. Most definitely. Should she? Well, that's sort of up to you as far as practice goes. And page 706, Spencer points out in his practice pointer box, there's actually quite a few default judgments that get vacated where the court finds good, saying, well, there was a clearly a good faith reason why they didn't come. So it would behoove you to at least pick up the phone and say, hey, are you planning on filing in this case? Because otherwise I'm going to move for default.
Not say it to be friendly and give them, well, let's give them 20 more days. You don't have to do that. But you don't want to get stung with vacating this order if it was a clear reason that they had to get out of it.
All right. Last bit, because there's just these two things, and we'll do 60 in our next class because we come back to it. Reckless comes to your office. He says, I have a default entry here, but no judgment has been given. What do you do? 55C tells you to move the court to set aside the entry of default. And how do they decide to do this?
Good cause shown,
which is excusable neglect plus you have a viable defense in the case.
It's excusable neglect plus you have a viable defense in the case.
How does it change? And that's H, is just if they already had a judgment, now you need to also use 55C and 60.
And we'll go back over 60, so don't worry about it. I'll repost these and we'll go back over 60, because 60 is still rather finished covering. All right. Why don't you come up and see me? I don't want to. Okay. All right. Thanks.
I have a quick question for you. I missed this. So the consequences of appearing and then being in default, the clerk has to enter the judgment. And
next
then
judgment, yeah.
Yes.
So you want to make sure you put judgment here. Okay, they're different, you know.
Yes. And then under 55B2, they get 7 days notice of what? Of the hearing, and that's it. Okay, cool. Thank you.
I'm confused on why you wouldn't.
We just stopped.
Sorry. Okay.